Hi everyone, thanks for tuning in to Josie Student Nurse, where we will be applying what we know to common med-surg disease process. Today we will be covering mechanical ventilation for an adult with respiratory illness. So, what is some of the reasons why we put a patient on mechanical ventilation? So they are in respiratory failure, and this could be one of two reasons. They have an issue with ventilation, or they're having an issue with oxygenation. So these two types of failing mechanism in our lungs can have many different reasons. Let's start with ventilatory failure. So when we have a patient with ventilation issues, they have decrease in oxygen and an increase in CO2. So they are aren't having good inspiration or expiration. So they are not getting oxygen, but they are retaining CO2, which is an acid. So we'll see this patient with respiratory acidosis. We can also see them with thoracic pressure change. And with this, we have an abnormality with the patient, whether it be kyphosis, which is a patient who is humpback, COPD, and we can see them barrel-chested, and a pneumothorax. And when we have a patient with pneumothorax, this means they have air trapped in the lungs. And this definitely changes the anatomy of the lungs, making it hard to breathe, which leads to ventilatory failure and inadequate thoracic pressure change in the chest. We also have a defect in the respiratory control center. This meaning it could be a central nervous system dysfunction or a drug overdose such as opiates, heroin, or any kind of overdose that sedates the patient, making it hard to breathe. We also have impaired muscular function with ventilatory failure, being neuromuscular disease like Guillain-Barré, MS, or maybe even a spinal cord injury. Next, we have the second type of respiratory failure, mostly pertaining to oxygenation. So we have inadequate perfusion between the lungs and the heart, or the lungs and the alveoli. The first type is the shunt. So when we have a right to left shunt, there's a problem with air not getting down to the alveoli, and you don't get good perfusion, and we need good blood flow through the pulmonary capillary. And this is definitely an oxygenation failure issue. Alright, another example for inadequate perfusion is a pulmonary embolism. A pulmonary embolism blocks the flow of oxygen getting to the alveoli, which makes it difficult to breathe and oxygenate. So we have also hemorrhagic shock and abnormal hemoglobin. And when you don't have abnormal hemoglobin, this could be anything from sickle cell, that you have carbon monoxide poisoning, you don't have that hemoglobin in your blood to bind with that O2. So that's definitely an oxygenation failure issue. We also have inadequate diffusion, either with abnormal alveolar capillary unit at the actual alveoli. We have pulmonary edema, and we have ARDS as well. Alright, so these are some of the risk factors and pathophysiology of why we need to put a patient on a vent. Alright, so what kind of ventilators are there? we have one of two types. We have one, a negative pressure ventilator, and we also have the positive pressure ventilator. So what is a type of negative pressure ventilator? This is the type of vent you see on the outside of a patient that forces air in. It's a non-invasive, and it's used mostly for neuromuscular disorders. We also see this used to looking like that iron lung that Christopher Reeves was in. Nowadays, it is the turtle shell encased around the chest of a patient, and it encases the body trunk of a patient, which helps them breathe. It helps the chest wall and forces pressure in to the patient by moving the outside of the chest wall up and down with a negative pressure. We also have positive pressure ventilators. It's the second type of ventilator. This one is invasive. This requires a trach to be put down a patient's airway. We need a positive pressure ventilators because it delivers air through positive pressure directly into the patient's lungs. All right. And how is a vent delivered to a patient? We usually see this with done with a what's called a laryngoscope, and it rests 1 to 2 centimeters above the carina with a light attached to the end. This holds the airway open, and it's called an endotracheal tube, or we also call it an ET tube. And this is our artificial airway. Further nursing management on the ET tube will be later discussed in a little bit in this podcast. So, why do we want to put an ET tube down our patient? And how do we do it? With a laryngoscope, it's protective of the airway, delivers the positive pressure, and we want this to remain short term. We don't want the patient to rely on this as the only airway. Now, we cannot put an ET tube in a patient that is, in distress or awake. So when this is usually delivered, it's with 1, a sedative, and 2, a neuromuscular blocking agent. So a paralysis. So the first drug for sedation is called etomidate. And this is a sedative. We also have succinylcholine and rocuronium for the paralysis. These are NBAs that paralyzes at the skeletal muscle, and it depolarizes at the acetylcholine sites, and it's also short-acting. Whenever we give these drugs, what are kind of the nursing management things that we'll do for the patient? We're going to monitor the effects, so we're going to monitor the effects of the paralysis by giving twitches to the patient. We are going to confirm breath sounds in the patient, so we'll also listen with our stethoscope for the breath sounds. Once the patient is intubated, we'll take some tape, and we'll mark the tube where it touches the tooth of the patient. So that's how we know if the ET tube it has moved or not. We want to also confirm placement of the ET tube with a chest x-ray. And we also want to make sure that the patient doesn't hurt themselves or try to pull out their tube and This also keeps them safe from also being sedated, so we'll restrain them. All right, so what are some of the ventilator controls and settings? So we have the FiO2, which is a fraction of inspired oxygen. So this is the percentage of the amount of oxygen the patient is getting. And this could either be between 21% to 100% of oxygen. So how do we know how much oxygen the patient needs? Well, the goal for the amount of oxygen they get is to provide enough provide the most oxygen to prevent O2 toxicity. So as much as they need, really. The next setting for the ventilator would be tidal volume. How much air are they going to get with each breath? And this is usually calculated with their weight in kilograms. So you take their weight in kilograms and you add a zero. And this is an estimate of how much volume their lungs are going to be able to receive. We also have the rate. How many breaths do we want our patient to have? And this usually depends on if they're first starting on the ventilation to when we want to start weaning them off the ventilation. So the rate is how many breaths they'll be taking in 1 minute. So the normal amount of breaths we take a minute is either between 10 to 14 breaths a minute. And this will range depending on what mode the ventilator is on. Okay, so the different modes we have is the CMV, which is continuous. We have AC, which is assist control. We have SIMV, which is synchronized intermittent monitor of ventilation. And that sounds a little intimidating at first, but I could break that down for you. And then we have PEEP, which is a setting. It means positive end expiratory pressure. We also have CPAP. Now, the first mode we'll be talking about is SMV, and this is continuous ventilation. This is full ventilatory support for a patient who is not breathing on their own at all. So it's got a preset tidal volume and rate. The next we have assist control. So this ventilator mode takes over the complete work of breathing and delivers a preset tidal volume and rate. So this is totally assistive. This is an arresting mode. It's total control of the work of breathing the patient is doing. Next we have SIMV. So we have a set volume and rate, and I usually like to correlate the S and SIMV to spontaneous. So the SIMV gives a volume and rate, but it also allows spontaneous breathing. So it's giving the patient ventilation, but can detect when the patient tries to take random breaths on their own. Next, we also have PEEP, and this is a setting, and it means positive end expiratory pressure. So when the patient is breathing out, positive pressure is forced in. So the purpose of this is to open up the airways, open up the alveoli at the end of when the patient is breathing out. So more pressure at the end of expiration increases oxygenation and gas exchange, and also opens up that alveoli to get some oxygenation going on there. We also have CPAP. So CPAP means continuous positive airway pressure. So this is continuous airway pressure, and it doesn't stop. It increases oxygenation and gas exchange and also prevents atelectasis. And it requires spontaneous breathing. So whenever the patient wants to breathe on their own and take a random breath, They'll always get continuous air. And then we have peak inspiratory pressure, PIP. This is pressure needed to deliver a set tidal volume. So when you're at the highest pressure reach during inspiration. So when you're taking a deep breath in, the highest pressure patient is taking with each breath, a set tidal volume of air is exerted. So what are some of the other controls on the ventilator? We have the high pressure alarm and the low pressure alarm. So with a high pressure alarm, I like to think of a blockage or something that's building up because it's cut off. Or when you take a hose that's running and you fold it in half and you kink it and then you unkink it. Water flows harder out of the end of the hose. So, what do we want to do? Something's blocking it. We have a high pressure alarm. Air is building up in the line. We either have increased secretion, so we want to suction the patient and see if that'll help. The patient's coughing and gagging, which means that they may need more sedative or an NBA. They're biting the ET tube, they're fighting it and they're bucking it. The patient has a pneumothorax, or they may even be lying on the tubing. It may even be kinked, or we may have water in the tubing. A low pressure alarm means air is leaking out, so the patient isn't getting the set volume of air that they're supposed to be getting, so the breaths aren't getting delivered. There might be a leak in the cuff or a leak in the circuit, and this actually prevents or stops breathing and stops the client from breathing in SINV or CPAP mode. All right, so let's go over some pharmacological therapies our patient may be on with mechanical ventilation. So when they are sedated, they will either be on usually Versed or Diprivan, which is propofol, which is a cardiac depressant. It's usually used mostly in the ICU or during surgery. It decreases anxiety and produces amnesia. So propofol is an IV drip, decreases anxiety, makes them go night-night, and produces amnesia, so when the patient wakes up, they won't remember anything. We also have Versed, which is more short-acting than propofol. It's a sedative as well, CNS depressant, and it's for when the ET tube is inserted. So, what are some of the nursey things that we want to do for sedation? We want to monitor side effects and therapeutic effects. We also want to monitor the level of sedation using either the RASS or Ramsey's sedation scale. We also want them to be paralyzed, so we'll use the NBAs. We have either Pavilion or Tracheum. These are going at either with an IV bolus or through a continuous infusion. So these are non-depolarizing agents that produce paralysis, and they also prevent the patient from bucking the ventilator. These are used with sedation and analgesia, so the patient doesn't feel pain and they're sleeping. The side effects for the NBAs is prolonged skeletal muscle weakness. So when you imagine a patient being under NBAs, they are moving. So when they wake up, their muscles have been trained to, not be used for a while. It's very important to do passive and active range of motion with the patient while they're on NBAs, so you can kind of prevent skeletal muscle weakness after a while. So we want to prevent the patient from And what does that mean? We want to protect the patient from environment, and they're on paralysis type medications. Basically, when we're turning and repositioning them, they have, you know, pillows on their side. We want to, you know, give them that humanistic care when we are turning and repositioning them. We want to make sure that all of the lines and cords are away from them, and, you know, they're safe, and we'll protect them from the environment in that way. You know, we want to watch where their head is, or where their arms are, and constantly doing a thorough assessment every time we walk in the room. So with NBAs, we also want to monitor effects. And how do we monitor the effects for paralysis? So we have the train of four, which is a peripheral nerve stimulator. So what we'll do is we'll attach an electrode to the ulnar nerve, and whatever or however many twitches we get is the percentage of how sedated the patient is. So with three twitches, that is, from the electrode stimulator, we have three twitches, that's 80% paralysis. We have one twitch, we have that's 90% paralysis, or we have two twitches, and that's 75% paralysis on that patient. All right, so we also have some bronchodilators we use for the patient. As far as pharmacological therapies, we have albuterol, and these are all administered by respiratory therapy through the vent circuit. So we have albuterol. This relaxes smooth muscle. You'll see a high blood pressure or a tachycardic patient with albuterol. We have Atrovent, which blocks constriction of the smooth muscle. So it relaxes smooth muscle, and it doesn't really have any side effects, and it's used in adjunct with the albuterol. We have Mucomist, which liquefies secretion. So you'll have liquefied secretions, and those are really easy to suction through the ET tube for that patient. So they'll be able to breathe easier and increase oxygenation in their case. Mucomist is used with a bronchodilator because we want to dilate the bronchioles and relax that smooth muscle to prevent bronchospasms, because Mucomist side effect is bronchospasm. So we'll put that with a bronchodilator. We also have some inhaled corticosteroids such as beclomethasone. The mechanism of this is suppresses an inflammatory response. So with inflammatory response, we'll see vasoconstriction, but when we want to suppress that with the corticosteroid, that'll help open up the airways for us. But with using corticosteroids, we do have an increased risk for infection with using steroids, and this increases our blood sugar, our cortisol. So we'll want to monitor the temperature, white blood cells, lung sounds, and if any coughing in that patient. All right, so our patient on mechanical ventilation, what are some of the nursey things that we want to manage for them? We want to assess their vital signs. We want to do a really, really good thorough respiratory assessment. We want to get their rate, pattern, breath sounds. We want to see their chest rise and fall equally. And we want to make sure they're clear front and back. We want to monitor their ABGs and pulse ox. We will also assess the ET tube and the surrounding area. So every day we will switch the ET tube from each side of the mouth, and we'll mark the level where the tube touches the client's teeth. We'll reposition it daily, and we'll make sure that it's positioned and taped down well, and we'll keep that tension off that ET tube so we can better oxygenate that patient. We want to suction the patient. We don't want to suction them too much because we can irritate the airway if we do suction them too much and cause bleeding, and they might be able to aspirate that. So we need to be careful with that. We want to make sure we get really good mouth care going on with that patient every day. And when the patient is able to wake up, we do have good communication with them, either with a pen and pencil, nodding, using a whiteboard as well. And then we want to use restraints to maintain tube placement. We want to do some vent checks. We want to make sure that the O2 rate and the mode are all what they should be. We want to make sure that respond to the high pressure, low pressure alarms, and if any water is in the tubing, we can drain that. Alrighty. Some complications with mechanical ventilations. We have GI. We will go over infection. We will also go over weaning and any cardiac complications. So we'll start with cardiac. So the patient is at risk for low blood pressure or hypotension due to increase in positive pressure in the thoracic cavity. So with an invasive ET tube is going down our patient's mouth and down into their lungs. This forces air into their lungs, which creates positive pressure. Positive pressure can collapse our lungs because we actually run on negative pressure. And when we can't do it ourselves, positive pressure builds in the thoracic cavity, decreases our blood pressure, and inhibits blood return to the heart, which leads to decrease in cardiac output and fluid retention. So I want to monitor their blood pressure, INOs, their weight, and if any, edema. We'll also see some lung complications in this barotrauma, which is damaged by positive pressure in pneumothorax, or volutrauma, which is excessive volume. So too much FiO2 can be dangerous and even toxic and expand the lungs too much, more than it'll be able to handle. So we want to do a really good respiratory assessment on those. So we also have GI complications. We have the patient at risk for stress ulcers because they're sedentary, they're laying down, they don't have good peristalsis going on. So when we stop the motion going on in their gut, they are at risk for increasing the permeability in their gut, and this leads to, open capillaries in the colon, and this is puts them at risk for infection and risk for bacteria translocating to that site. So we don't want that. We will prevent that by giving them either PPIs, which is proton pump inhibitors, or H2R blockers, which is Xantax. And these prevent stress ulcers, which is essential for patients on mechanical vents, because we want to prevent them the ulcers, and we don't want to open up that mucosa to get any infection going on there. So we'll put them on a high protein, high fat, high calorie diet, and we'll monitor their electrolytes, and any electrolytes that are low, we'll supplement by hanging that through an IV. So we want them on a high calorie, high protein, high fat, usually called Pulmacare, and too much carbon dioxide actually increases CO2. All right, so and other modes of infection would be ventilator-associated pneumonia. So after the ET tube is bypassed through the carina and into the lungs of the patient, after 48 hours, the ET tube is colonized with bacteria, and they can aspirate these secretions, and that increases bacteria to be set in our lungs and can lead to pneumonia. So how do we prevent these? What are some evidence-based interventions that we can do? Oral care, hand washing, of course. Antibiotic control. We want to control the antibiotics because if they do get a broad spectrum antibiotic, they'll become resistant and the antibiotics will have any control in their body. We want them at the head of the bed over 30 degrees. We want to monitor their glycemic control either with a decrease in sugar, or insulin drip, or bicarb drip. Stress ulcer prophylaxis with our PPIs and our H2R blockers. We don't want to change the tubing or circuit less than 24 hours. And we want to suction them through a closed ET tube. We don't want to detach that and open that up to the air. Alright, so our patient's doing better now, and we want to start taking them off the vent. What are some of the things that we can do for them? So, in this case, we'll start what we call weaning them. So, when they are getting better, and they are taking more breaths on their own through SIMV, we'll gradually decrease the rate. So, like we said before, SIMV allows the patient to take spontaneous breaths on their own. And when we see that they're taking more breaths on their own, we'll decrease the rate of spontaneous breathing. So this will show that they're ready to be decreased and weaned when our ABGs are coming back to normal and the patient was responding well through respiratory assessments. All right, and then once they have graduated off SIMV and they're taking mostly their own breaths and the SIMV is on the lowest rate possible, 1 to 2 breaths a minute, we'll put them on the TP. So TPs means that the vent is taken off the ET tube and a TP is replaced on that ET tube and the patient's taken off the vent and they're able to breathe on their own. So that we either have a T-piece on there or the patient's put on CPAP so they have continuous air and they can take their own breaths. We also have pressure support ventilation. So with this, the pressure of the volume of air that the patient is getting is decreased and decreased and decreased, which enables the patient to compensate and take more of a respiratory effort to get that pressure of air in their lungs. So they're trying more to get that pressure of air in their lungs by gradually decreasing them from it. All right, so our patient's doing well. They're taking most breaths on their own, so we can extubate them. And we're removing the ET tube. And with this, we will monitor. And what are some of the things that we will monitor? We will monitor and make sure that we hyperoxygenate the patient. We suction them really, really well so that when they are extubated, they don't have a bunch of secretions going on for when they do start to fight for air and breathe on their own. We will deflate the cuff. We'll make sure the patient coughs and we'll administer more supplemental O2. And when they are weaned, we'll put them in a semi-Fowler's position. I'm sorry, when they are extubated, we'll put them in a semi-Fowler's position. We'll encourage them to take deep breaths, use the incentive spirometer, cough, deep breathe, and we'll monitor vital signs, respiratory pattern, ventilatory pattern every hour. And we'll also make sure that they don't need to be put back on mechanical ventilation. And when we want to monitor for signs of respiratory distress, we'll usually see dyspnea. They'll be coughing. They won't have the ability to expectorate, which means cough up secretion. So when this happens, when they can't cough up secretions and they're coughing and they're fighting for air and they have an increased work of breathing, we need to notify the physician because they may need to be put on more mechanical ventilation again. We'll also see Strider, and you'll be able to hear Strider either without a stethoscope or with a stethoscope. Alrighty, that is it for mechanical ventilation.